Call to order this meeting of the Minnesota Senate Taxes Committee, Thursday, March 21st, 2024, at 8:36 a.m. First item is adoption of the minutes. You have the minutes before you. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, without any objection, the minutes are approved as presented. The first bill on our agenda is Senate File 3958. Senator Putnam. Senator Putnam, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. You know, at the risk of courting controversy at the beginning of my presentation of this bill, I'm going to make a fairly dangerous statement and say that sometimes government is not rational. And maybe sometimes it should be a little bit more so. And that's why today I present Senate File 3958, which is both simple and reasonable. Senate File 3958 would provide a sales tax exemption for cottage foods. The bill is one sentence. That's what it does.
And we'll want you to go through it in detail.
Madam Chair, would you like me to do a sentence tree, a tree diagram? I actually could do that for you if you want. So, Madam Chair, members, the bill is important because it streamlines a complex state system for small food makers and farmers who sell food under the Department of Agriculture's existing cottage food exemption. So you may be wondering, what exactly is cottage food? Cottage food is an exemption from licensure that allows farmers or other emerging entrepreneurs to sell non-hazardous foods and canned goods direct to consumer. So think your local farmer's market. That's often what allows farmers to sell jams and jellies and things like that made from the stuff that they've grown. The cottage food exemption is limited, allowing no more than $78,000 in annual sales. But most importantly, 95% of those producers make less than $8,000 in sales annually. One way to conceptualize cottage foods and its benefit is that it's not only a kind of more organic food system, it's also an opportunity for burgeoning entrepreneurs who want to test to see if that's something that they want to do, to begin a small business. It's very important to be clear that cottage foods is not the same thing as a licensed business, and we have to protect what makes it special while enabling the people who do this work to do the best that they can. Now, from a tax perspective, when cottage food producers sell foods at farmers markets, they have to deal with this incredibly complicated matrix to determine what food is taxable. And this is that matrix. It's a flow chart, and it's incredibly confusing. Members, for example, salsa is taxable, but spaghetti sauce is not. And the rationale for that is because you eventually heat spaghetti sauce. Folks, that doesn't make a ton of sense. So this results in a ton of confusion on the part of the food makers and the staff and volunteers at farmers markets, because that's who we're talking about. We're talking about volunteers and the people who actually produce these things, not accountants. But there's another issue here too. There's the matter of equity, because when you walk across the street to a grocery store from a farmers market, that jar of salsa is not taxed. So members, this bill is pretty simple, obviously. And these are truly small businesses on the path towards emerging small businesses who would benefit from our support. And I hope that we can make our tax system more simple and more fair through this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Putnam, is cottage foods defined in the statutes?
It is, Madam Chair.
Okay, is that close by this? I'm just curious of what the definition of cottage foods is.
It was put into statute in 2015. Let's see. The statute includes details on prior training, registration, types of food allowed, food labeling, types of sales locations, and amounts of sales allowed by a cottage food producer. There are, as I suggested earlier, there's two tiers to cottage food production. One is, I think, under 8,000, and one is up to 78,000. Okay. So your total sales for that period have to be under that in order for you to satisfy the exemption.
I see. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Are there any other questions for Senator Putnam?
Madam Chair.
If not, I think there are two. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I suspect we're going to hear from our testifiers the answer to your question. They were a part of the effort to initially pass cottage foods into law back in 2015, of which I was the chief author. So, and there is a definition. I'm looking it up for you right now.
Okay, thank you, Senator Dibble. We have two testifiers. They're both testifying on Zoom. We'll begin with Betsy Wentz. But I see Kathy Zeman came up. But either way, Ms. Zeman, if you're prepared to start off, we can start with you.
Thank you. Chair Rest, Senator Putnam, and members of the Senate Taxes Committee, good morning. I am Kathy Zeman, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Farmers Market Association. And thank you for letting me Zoom in this morning to testify in support of Senate File 3958 to exempt cottage foods from sales tax. MFMA supports all 375 farmers markets in Minnesota and the tribal nations and their 10,000 or so vendors. Minnesota Statute 28A.152 is the cottage food law, and it was put into play in 2015 with Senator Dibble's leadership. It does define cottage food in there. It defines it. It goes back to the Minnesota Food Code 4626.0020, and it has to be it cannot be potentially hazardous. The foods have to have a pH of 4.6 or below, so fairly acidic, so that bad germs can't grow at room temperature, or it has to have a water activity level of less than 0.85 so that there's not a lot of free-floating water molecules in that baked goods to attract bad bacteria. So I'd like to really thank Senator Putnam's leadership on this cottage foods issue as he engaged his team to help research and surface a possible solution. Sales tax on certain foods that our food farmers and cottage food producers make and sell has really been one of the most vexing issues for us to resolve. And part of the problem was that the Department of Revenue defines the words prepared food much differently than the Department of Ag or Department of Health who issue the food licenses. Exempting all cottage foods from sales tax brings some equity to the cottage foods industry and to our food farmers, since baked prepared foods are already exempt from sales tax. But the other prepared foods, like jams and jelly sold by fruit and veggie farmers who are cottage food producers, do have to pay that sales tax. Produce farmers who make and sell acidified cottage foods like salsa and spaghetti sauce using the exact same ingredients in both products face a unique conundrum. Salsa is taxed, but spaghetti sauce is not, as Senator Putnam said, because if you heat it to eat it, there's no sales tax. Selling cottage foods to SNAP customers presents a particularly unique challenge since SNAP foods cannot be taxed. Cottage food producers of baked goods, of course, are already exempted from sales tax, but our produce farmers and our food makers selling salsa, they cannot charge sales tax to SNAP shoppers, but they do have to charge sales tax to the non-SNAP shoppers buying salsa at the same time, at the same table, at the same farmers market. So we believe that Senate File 3958 is a good solution for Minnesota cottage food producers, food farmers, and the thousands of Minnesotans who buy their foods directly from the makers and farmers. Thanks for listening, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Ms. Seaman, I would point out that irrespective of any definitions by the Department of Agriculture, the tax system, the sales tax system, is bound by the definitions of prepared foods by our streamlined sales tax agreement, and anything other than that would put us in violation of that statutory agreement. So we're unlikely to change the definition of prepared foods, and actually might suggest to the Department of Agriculture that they adopt the streamlined definition. And then we would be in sync with them, as well as with our compact with 21 other states. That, and of course, that compact doesn't relate to whether you tax something or you don't tax something or what the rate is, but it does have a common definitions. That's what most of Streamline does. Everybody can rely on the definition of prepared foods, regardless of what other kinds of regulations or statutes are going to be applied to it. So just that one piece of information. Senator Putnam, is your other, I can't see the names up there, but is Ms. Wentz here? Okay, I was told she was going to be on the Zoom call, but apparently not. So that is the presentation. Senator Dibble, did you have further comments you'd want to make about how wonderful the cottage food industry is?
It is wonderful. Actually, this was it's a great story. I won't tell it right now, but it came about in response to constituents who had been doing home baking and trying to sell their baked goods, and then ran into, you know, the buzzsaw, the gaping maw of bureaucracy, and Ms. Zeman and others jumped in to help us. I said that specifically for Senator Drazkowski. but it was great. It was a great story. You know, a lot of stakeholders, and we figured it out. And since that time, we've been adding to it, you know, increasing the monetary thresholds and the types of foods that can be included, and the like. So it's a great story, and a lot of people have jumped in, and you know, the farmers market and kind of the locally produced food movement has joined the cause. And so when you go to farmers markets, you can buy a lot of great prepared foods that people have made in their kitchens, and it's great. And people are making a little side hustle. People are making their living off this, but it's little bit of extra income for folks.
Thank you, Senator Dibble, and it's just been pointed out to me that maybe the updating should go the other way around. Department of Revenue and the Streamline definition is fairly old, and maybe it needs to be updated to indicate a more modernization of it and the regulations that indeed do have an impact on how those foods are prepared and how they must be prepared for health reasons as well as whether they're a taxable good or not.
Madam Chair, I'm glad that's how you ended that sentence, because when you said things might go the other way around, I thought you were going to suggest we tax everything.
Oh, no. No. are there further questions or comments for Senator Putnam or his witness? Seeing none, thank you very much. I do draw members' attentions to the revenue estimate. The effective date is June 30th of 2024, or after that, meaning July 1st. And there's some information in the revenue estimate on the basis on which they put together the revenue estimate in terms of the number of of cottage foods sellers and the cap on their sales for the year in order to have that designation as a cottage food seller. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Putnam. And Senate File 3958 is laid over.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Rest. Senate File 4653 is before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the 2023 omnibus bill, we changed the rate at which the limit on itemized deductions for individual taxpayers was going to phase out, and when it started to phase out. And that's current. The fact that it happens is current law, was current law, and what we did was to change the percentage at the end point of that. So the but that's not so that that is now current law, what that percentage is, and I believe it's at 80% now. Had been at, started at 70, but now it's at 80. One of the things that was pointed out to me after our bill passed is the impact it would have on high-income Minnesotans relative to their willingness, eagerness, whatever word you want to use there, to continue making charitable contributions at the levels that they previously had done, because more of them, as the bundle of itemized deductions, were allowed. So I spoke with folks that pay very close attention to the level of itemized deductions or the level of charitable contributions that depend upon individuals of means. And so we have the 2.5 just adds the deductions for charitable contributions is exempt from that phase out, just as two others, two other categories of otherwise expenses are allowed as well. And I bring this bill, it's more, I mean, we'll lay it over, but it's more for just an informational purposes to indicate just how much the that those charitable contributions from folks who have adjusted gross incomes over $220,000, and then excuse me, the once you get to the 80%, that the after you have an adjusted gross income of over $1 million, it's just 80%. It doesn't continue to go any further than that, but you only get 20% of your itemized deductions if your adjusted gross income is $1 million. And so I introduced the bill so that we could have that brief enlightenment, or that's the way I felt about it. And if you look at the, and so that's the only thing that's in this bill. 2.5, it just includes that. But what does it cost? It costs, starting in FY25, it costs $121,200,000. So what does that mean? That means that if you're not allowed to make those charitable contributions, similarly to what you would have been allowed if we had stayed at 70%, charities, 501c3s across the state and wherever, for Minnesota purposes, not for the federal purposes, would lose $121 million. So I thought it was worth a look worth our time just taking a brief look at that, and which is not to say that in the 2023 bill we still wouldn't have kept it the way it was that it was passed, but we probably should have been more self-aware of what some of the provisions that were in the bill. That was not an error like the NOL. I mean, the NOL was clearly, we made an error there in the language not following the spreadsheet. We knew that, not specifically, that charitable contributions were going to be included in those limits, but that and we weren't making exceptions for them, but I would contend we didn't understand quite the impact on the revenue estimate in our bill in 2023. So that's why I bring this bill today, and if you have any questions or comments or complaints or whatever, I certainly invite you to make them. But otherwise, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Mortensen is here to testify on the public policy benefits of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Ms. Katina Mortensen, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Rest and members of the committee. My name is Katina Mortensen, and I am the Vice President of Policy and Partnerships at the Minnesota Council on Foundations. The Minnesota Council on Foundations is a membership association for grantmakers across the state. We have over 150 members, and we are focused on connecting, strengthening, and mobilizing philanthropy for prosperity and equity in Minnesota. As a statewide association for Minnesota grantmakers, we care deeply about promoting charitable giving and supporting a strong nonprofit sector. We look closely at federal and state changes to the standard and itemized deductions, as they can have an impact on charitable giving incentives and behaviors. Today we are here in support of Senate File 4653, which would restore Minnesota charitable giving tax incentives impacted by changes made during the 2023 legislative session. According to MCF, and that's the Minnesota Council on Foundations, most recent Giving in Minnesota report, individual donors in Minnesota provide substantial resources to nonprofits. In 2021, individuals donated $5.61 billion to nonprofits, and philanthropic organizations contributed $2.9 billion. So individual giving is a very substantial source of revenue for nonprofits. This data highlights the generosity of individual Minnesotans, and charitable tax incentives are an important way to encourage giving and ensure nonprofits have the resources they need to help communities thrive. Nationally, we are seeing individual giving trends that paint a concerning picture for nonprofits and the communities that they serve. According to GivingUSA's 2023 report, individual giving declined 13.4% after adjusted for inflation in 2022, only the fourth time that donations have fallen in the last 40 years. The same report found that charitable giving as a share of personal disposable income dropped to 1.7%, a near 30-year low. And according to the Fundraising Effectiveness Project quarter four 2022 report, a decline from what they term as supersized donors, or those contributing more than $50,000, is responsible for almost half of the overall decline in giving. These giving trends are happening at a time of growing demand for services and rising expenses for nonprofits. The 2023 law substantially reduced the value of itemized charitable deductions for those with the resources to make the largest contributions, in particular those with an adjusted gross income over $1 million. We are concerned that this tax change will only further exacerbate downward giving trends, ultimately hurting nonprofit bottom lines and negatively impacting the communities they serve. And I will say, charitable dollars are really essential to maintaining a healthy civil society They're vital to both nonprofit charities and local governments that depend on these resources to achieve their critical missions. This is also good tax policy. It encourages individuals to give away more of their income, devoting it to community needs rather than their own. We're fortunate in Minnesota to have a strong history of having a robust nonprofit and philanthropic sector, and the state has had a strong commitment to the sector through the itemized charitable deduction and the non-itemizer deduction that, that we have as a state. The sector is also very important to Minnesota's economy. According to the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits Nonprofit Economy Report, the sector employs 13.8% of Minnesota's workforce, which is about 384,000 employees. So this reduction in the state's investment, which has returned, according to the revenue estimate, $3.1 billion in itemized charitable contributions, is a concern to us, and we feel like it could be hurtful to nonprofit revenues. So by excluding, in this bill, by excluding charitable giving from the accelerated itemized phase down that was passed in 2023, Minnesota would be preserving the state's charitable giving incentive, ensuring that nonprofits can continue to rely on individual donors of all income levels to contribute to causes that lead to thriving and equitable communities in our state. So thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Mortensen. Member questions or comments or amendments?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rust.
I wonder if how quickly Mr. Munn could look up the charitable, not the charitable, the itemized deduction feature of the 2023 bill and how much tax revenue was estimated by this even further accelerated. It was already accelerated, but this further accelerated limitation on itemized deduction.
Mr. Mum, you're on the spot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, when the deduction changes were enacted last year, the estimate was approximately $354 million in the current biennium and $385 million in the 26-27 biennium.
Thank you. So members, just to point out the impact then, of the $354 million that was in revenue raised, just back of the envelope calculations, over a third of that came from the limitation on charitable deductions in the itemized deductions category. I think I think we should just be aware of that and what the impact of it was. So,
with that, Senate File 4653 is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest, Senate File 4725 is in front of the committee. I understand you have an amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I move the A1 amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A1 as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? A1 is adopted. Senator Rest to Senate File 4725 is amended.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The issue of the relative weight or authority of tax court decisions on actions or inactions by the Department of Revenue has been an issue for some time because of one particular case, the Nadler decision, which was years ago. And it was a decision that later on not followed by the Department of Revenue for whatever reasons, and I'm sure I would like to call first Commissioner Markor to just give a little bit of history of that before we call the witnesses, of just how that came about, and perhaps speaking more to current policy of the Department of Revenue, but that but is why the bill is in front of us today, and the effect of the amendment is not to not to be contrary to the authority of higher courts over the authority of the tax court, and the original language could have given that impression. So that is what the amendment does, and all of that is in occurs on under section B of the bill. So.
Thank you, Chair Rest. Did you want Commissioner Markor to come forward? Mm-hmm. Commissioner Markor.
I believe he's here.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Markor, the Commissioner, Department of Revenue. So thank you so much for letting me testify in House File 4722. Usually I'm not here before this committee unless I'm talking about the governor's tax proposal or a position that the governor has on a bill. Neither one applies in this case. But the issue here is so important and crucial to the proper tax administration of this state that I thought I'd provide some comments. I mean, the city management case and this bill gets to the real crucial portion of what you need to do to administer a tax system or a tax code. And that is, as a department, we have to really look at being transparent, being accountable, making sure that what we do instills trust and confidence in our taxpayers as they go to navigate through a tax code. And so this bill gets to that. And while I might have some concerns about the bill overall, I and the department strongly support the intent of this bill. And, you know, as I was reading that city management case, anytime you see the words outrageous and commissioner in the same sentence by a Supreme Court, you take note. And as I looked at that case, I was very disappointed. Because even though the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the department as far as assessing the taxpayer, they strongly criticized the process the department used back in 2006 through 2017, and rightfully so. And so as we move forward on this, what happened back in, and I know that Madam Chair wanted me to talk a little bit to this, but back in 2006, there was a tax court case, the Nadler case, that ruled very specifically on a tax rule. It was against the Department of Revenue. At the time, the Department of Revenue said internally, we are not going to abide by this ruling. And I guess that's one thing, but then did not make that public for 10 years until 2017. In the meantime, there was one, you know, at least one taxpayer with city management that used that Nadler decision, saying, well, here is basically what was ruled. The department never said anything. They never appealed. And so we're going to abide by that. And so then this company did that. And then the Department of Revenue later on came back to audit them after the fact and said, you know, you didn't apply this properly. What was greatly disappointing is that what happened there is really against all the values and standards that we strive to do today at the Department of Revenue. And what this bill gets to is creating clarity, making sure that when there's decisions, we're transparent, we're accountable, because that's going to be the only way that, you know, we have a voluntary tax compliance system. And the way you're going to have a successful system is by having taxpayers knowing they have faith and trust and confidence in the decisions and the direction that the Department of Revenue is moving. And when I talk to the department, I always say that we in the Department of Revenue, like other state agencies, we are a window to democracy. And that experience that the taxpayer has with that department, being the Department of Revenue, good or bad, will determine the faith and trust they have in democracy. And we take that very seriously at the Department of Revenue. So kind of want to cover what we've done, because what is in this statute, we basically are doing. So after November, when this case came out last November, I asked staff, would you please take a good look to see if there's any other Nadlers out there, so to speak? You know, are there any type of things where you've got a clear-cut rule and so forth? So certainly that was number one. I will say that just last month we lost a case in the tax court. We are not going to appeal, and we will be sending out guidance as to the new direction that the department will be taking. And I also had staff take a look at recent. So in the last 3 years, the Department of Revenue has lost 14 cases before the tax courts, about 12% of all cases, because most cases are either dismissed or they're settled. But of the 14 cases that were lost, three of them we have appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the other 11, we are not appealing, and we are abiding by the tax court ruling. So that's what we're striving to do. And I certainly understand what this bill wants to do. I could give you some other examples, but the bottom line is that the Department of Revenue recognizes, and we strive to do this every day, knowing that we need to provide clarity, we need to provide transparency, we need to provide accountability to our taxpayers, because the key to a voluntary tax compliance system is the trust and confidence that our taxpayers have in our tax code and this department. And that's what we strive to do every single day. So, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, certainly willing to work with you as you proceed on this bill into the future. And again, thank you for allowing me to testify today, and certainly open to any questions.
Before we go to testifiers, are there any questions for the Commissioner? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can tell, there's a reason I've been sitting in the back of the room today. But I have a question, Commissioner. Thank you for being here. Why does the department have the right not to abide by a tax court ruling? Because the citizens certainly are typically bound by that decision, unless they, again, go to the, appeal it to the Supreme Court. And so I'm just curious, because as I think back to the time that I chaired the property tax subcommittee, we had the situation with the pipeline settlement and in Rule 8100, and I understand there's being some reviews done on that rule. But the problem was compounded by the fact that the tax court made a ruling, and quite frankly, the department ignored it. And so it just kept compounding that problem. And what is the justification for that, Commissioner?
Commissioner Marquardt. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Weber, you know, I don't know if I can give you a really good answer on that, quite frankly, because a lot of the cases, even like the Rule 8100, we know when those valuations are put together, a lot goes into that. I mean, just, and so the tax court could rule on one portion of the many factors that are used to produce that valuation on those utilities under Rule 8100 that may not always apply to all the situations. So I think when you get back to the Nadler case, I think that was really clear cut. And I don't know if all the kind of all the rulings are necessarily clear cut, where there might be consistent over all taxpayers and it may not apply properly. But to me, I think whenever there's a clear indication that we as a department have to either do one of two things, appeal it and then take it through the process, or at least say publicly through you know, general register or whatever we do, we're not going to follow, this is still going to be the way it's interpreted. But getting back to that, I mean, I think in most cases, the Department of Revenue has and always will follow that ruling, but there may be situations that just are not clear cut to actually be able to follow this without impacting other taxpayers. I mean, let's bring up, and I shouldn't maybe get into another area of appurtenances and attachments on things like this. Yes, I think hopefully we can get that one solved this year. But that was a case where it was a 1939 law, and there was a couple Supreme Court cases back in the 1950s. But other than that, there really hadn't been any changes. And we know yet that technically, all the advances that were made, it puts the Department of Revenue in a tough spot. We have to, you know, enforce, administrate as we see things. And by changing that, we could hurt the integrity of the tax system. We could impact other taxpayers. So that's why we end up having to stick pretty close to the law. And there's actually some other situations I could mention where we look at the law and it's very ambiguous, and we end up having to take one way or the other on kind of being able to administrate that. So, I mean, I was a legislator too. I mean, we don't always make the clearest laws that to administrate always. But so I don't have a concrete specific answer to that, but I think in almost all cases we're either making it public or we're appealing that, Senator, to some extent.
Mr. Chairman, I would you know, also point out that the amendment that we put on the bill does address when the Commissioner of Revenue decides not to follow a tax court decision, what obligations the commissioner has at that point in terms of giving notice. They can't wait 10 years. The commissioner has to provide a notice of that decision within 60 days of that, and then within 180 days of the decision to publish a revenue notice, so within 6 months, describing exactly, well, I won't use the word exactly, since there's so much ambiguity in these decisions and sometimes in the law, what the commissioner's intended interpretation, administration of the statute is going to be, and in particular, we have a provision in the first part, unless the commissioner has complied, that he is bound by those conclusions if they are not either pending appeal on a pending appeal on a timely appeal, or overturned by the Supreme Court or the Minnesota Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court. So we put some guardrails on that for the department, but in my mind, it's certainly time to be crystal clear as we can be with regard to the commissioner's authority and the commissioner's responsibility, both to a taxpayers and to the general public. So I'd like to thank Commissioner Marquardt, and then, Mr. Chairman, if you'd call forward the witnesses, unless there's an additional question for Commissioner Marquardt.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the one question I have, and I recognize that there's a provision in the law in this particular bill requiring notification. And I think in terms of notification for tax preparers, et cetera, those that are in the business, it is probably sufficient. In those instances where people perhaps are doing their tax return themselves, I question whether or not this notice will get to them. And I'm just wondering, my question is are there additional means by which notification can be made to the public other than the website, et cetera?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, there certainly is the website. There is a gov delivery if you're part of that. You can be there. There's certainly could be press releases and that, but that's always a challenge to get that out. And I understand what you're saying. And that's, you know, our outreach, we do a lot of outreach where we meet with a lot of various groups, but not necessarily always individuals who are not part in filing their own and so forth. That's a great question. I mean, we've got a communication department that gets out in all different avenues. I mean, we have Facebook and so forth also, but you're not going to always reach everyone, but we try to.
Thank you.
I would Senator point Rice. Out too, Mr. Chairman and Senator Weber, that I think it's very unlikely in the cases that are decided by the tax court that the taxpayer is there pro se. I mean, he or she is going to have an attorney that is probably going to follow very closely the actions of the department following a decision by the tax court.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just clearly, this is a huge improvement. That is the understatement, probably. But what I would say, there's one piece I didn't hear you discuss that I also think is really important, and that's Section 2, the limitations on assessment. I think that is another positive movement, and I was just wondering if you wanted to just discuss that little piece, because I think it's important for people to know.
Senator Rest or Commissioner.
You seen this is what she's talking about here?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes. No. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson. So, I guess, like I said, we're not taking a position on the bill today. So, I don't know if I want to get into a lot of the legalese. I think what we're doing right now, and just the fact that we're committed to the transparency and so forth, lends a lot to this, but I don't know all the legal ramifications of how that would deal exactly with the assessments, how that binds on assessments of various ruling. I just don't know all the legalities behind that to say exactly the support or non-support for that. Again, I'm going to say I 100% and the department 100% supports the tenor of this and the intent of this bill as far as the accountability and the trust and confidence and clarity we can provide to taxpayers.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, I did not mean to put you on the spot. Yeah. I just think the intent of this is important. Yeah. Prohibits the commissioner from issuing an assessment for underpayment of tax if the assessment is inconsistent with or in contravention of conclusions of law in a tax court decision. I think that's a bold step forward. And I'll just leave that as my opinion. I did not exactly mean to put you on the...
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Marquardt. Could Mr. Gino Fregnito and Ms. Jennifer...
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yes, if you would begin now with my testifiers. And we also have Ms. Push and then Ben Wagner.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Fregnito. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gino Fregnito, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Society of CPAs, and we are here today to support Senate File 4725 and thank Senator Rest and Senator Weber for bringing it forward. This bill will provide some clarity to the statutes about when tax court rulings apply and requires the department to provide notice if they do decide to take a position that it will not follow the decision and provide some rationale as to why that position was taken. CPAs and businesses often rely on the court rulings when deciding what position to take on a future tax question. Consistent application of the law and guidance from tax administrators is required so taxpayers can properly comply with the tax laws. When CPAs are advising clients, they prefer to know the answer to the tax questions before filing the return rather than potentially litigate it after the fact. This is much more efficient in terms of the use of resources and time for everybody involved, the taxpayer, the CPA, the Department of Revenue, and the courts. Taxpayers want to do the right thing up front, but can't do so if they're unsure of the rules of the game. We're asking Senate File 4725 to provide the transparency and certainty that, and for the Department of Revenue to tell us what the answer is. We may not agree with the answer, but knowing provides that clarity and certainty to move forward. And as Commissioner Marquardt referenced, this legislation does come out of the city's management case that the Minnesota Supreme Court heard last year, and it was interesting to read the opinion that both the majority and the dissenting opinions were troubled. The majority used the word troubled. The dissenting opinion actually used the word outrageous. So there's some actions here that were troubling to the Supreme Court, and we're looking to address those and provide that clarity and certainty. Members of the committee, Senate File 4725 is necessary to rebuild the trust and maintain the trust and confidence in Minnesota's tax system and make sure that it is fairly and equitably applied to all. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fregnito. Ms. Push, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer Push. I am a tax attorney at Frederickson and Byron in Minneapolis. And my testimony today reflects my personal views and not the views of Frederickson and Byron. Before I get started, I want to thank Commissioner Marquardt for his testimony. It is great to hear his opinions on transparency that is necessary with the Department of Revenue. At the heart of Senate File 4725 is government transparency. My testimony today will briefly address the most recent catalyst for this bill, the city's management case. In full disclosure, I was one of the representatives of city's management in that case. In 2006, the Minnesota Tax Court issued its decision in Nadler v. the Commissioner of Revenue. The decision determined how Minnesota should tax a particular type of transaction involving the sale of a business. Despite not appealing Nadler, the commissioner concluded that the Department of Revenue need not accept that decision and instead established a written internal policy to disregard it, indicating that the department believed it was not bound by tax court decisions. 9 years after the tax court issued Nadler, and having no access to or knowledge of the commissioner's internal policy, the taxpayer and city's management and her accountant relied on Nadler when selling her business. To be clear, the taxpayer relied on and followed an on-point public tax court decision to calculate the tax liability for this transaction, which she then paid. To her surprise, the commissioner ultimately assessed city's management's owner with nearly $500,000 in additional tax and even assessed a penalty. It wasn't until she filed a lawsuit challenging the assessment that the taxpayer learned through discovery that the commissioner not only had a written policy instructing the department's employees not to follow the tax court's decision, The commissioner knew taxpayers were relying on Nadler, and yet has said nothing for over 10 years. After spending significant time and resources defending the assessment, CMI appealed to the Supreme Court. In both its majority and dissenting opinions, the court specifically addressed its concerns regarding the commissioner's lack of transparency. Writing for the majority, Justice Moore wrote, "We are troubled by the commissioner's conduct that this case has brought to light. Rather than appealing the tax court's interpretation of tax law, with which the department disagreed, the commissioner decided internally, apparently without notice to the public, that the department would not acquiesce to the tax court's interpretation of the law. We fear that such actions do little to inspire the trust and confidence of taxpayers in Minnesota's tax system." Agreeing with this sentiment, Justice Anderson, joined by Chief Justice Hudson, wrote in the dissent, "What is perhaps most troubling about this conduct is the commissioner's lack of transparency." The dissent then asks, "How are we to expect taxpayers to have confidence in a system in which the commissioner ignores the tax court's interpretation of tax statutes and unilaterally adopts the commissioner's preferred interpretation of the law, all without notice to the public? Simply put, taxpayers deserve some assurance that if they prepare their tax returns in reliance on the tax court's interpretation of the law, the commissioner cannot subsequently change the rules." Members of this committee, Senate File 4725 provides this assurance and aims to instill confidence in our tax system. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Push. Mr. Wager, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. My name is Ben Wagner. I'm a tax controversy attorney at Wagner Tax Law. I'm grateful for the opportunity to discuss the merits of Senate File 4725, and in fact, found myself really heartened by the comments made by Commissioner Marquardt as it relates to restoring transparency, trust, and confidence in our tax system. I mean, I was quietly kind of cheering him on as he was testifying. One thing I would like to note, though, about the sort of the opportunity that we have here before us to restore that transparency and trust and confidence is that if we really wanted to take this even one step further, you would eliminate the provision that talks about how the commissioner has the right to issue a revenue notice disagreeing with the tax court's decision. I mean, the commissioner is uniquely positioned to take a stance and file an appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court and challenge any decision that it disagrees with at the Minnesota tax court level. We understand why that provision's in there, but if we're really gonna go sort of full out for transparency and trust and confidence, that provision is something of note. I think that Senator Weber identified something that I thought was very interesting in that, you know, this issue is a nonpartisan one. It doesn't affect just Democrats or Republicans. And, you know, as it relates to Minnesota's taxpayers, the sort of corporate giants of Minnesota probably have tax departments that can navigate the ambiguity and the lack of clarity that our tax system sort of creates naturally, and also when the Department of Revenue sort of takes a position like it did in Nadler. But really it's the Main Street businesses, the sort of mom and pop operations that suffer the most because they don't have the resources to understand that the department isn't sort of following or adhering to Minnesota tax court decisions, and they certainly don't have the resources to try to figure it out on their own. And so they're the ones that are left guessing. They're the ones that are left exposed to the assessment of tax and potentially penalties that can be really serious and sort of decimate their business. And so having Senate File 4725 try to restore some transparency and some trust and confidence in a system where someone like my grandmother who ran her concessions business from her kitchen table, right? She's not checking up on Minnesota tax court decisions. She's not checking up on revenue notices that the commissioner issues. So giving her the opportunity to operate a business without the sort of surprise that we saw occur in Nadler, I think is a giant step forward towards restoring, you know, the kind of confidence and trust that all taxpayers deserve in our tax system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Members, questions or comments for the testifier or the author? Senator Rest.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would also point out that I had invited after communication from Chief Judge Bowman to come and testify this morning, and she declined that 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 invitation, and I thought her comments should be public and not private. So just want to put that on the record.
Senator Oskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rust, I'd just like to thank you for bringing this bill. It's written very thoughtfully. It is, in my observation, the first real piece of oversight that I have seen in this institution happen in a long time within an originating committee. Of course, we have the Legislative Audit Commission that does some oversight. But within our committees, our responsibility includes oversight, exactly what you're doing here. And I just want to thank you, because this is what we should be doing more of. We identify time and again in our committees times when the agencies are not operating on behalf of the people they're intended to serve. And Commissioner Marquardt, thank you too. The spirit and the words and the candor that you brought forward are exactly that, to serve the people of the state, and you intend to do that. You communicated very well that reality, and Senator Rust, your effort here in this bill will work to ensure and preserve that long after we're gone, if this is enacted into law. So just like to thank you.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in this discussion that I've been listening to, the one element that still troubles me, and I agree with Senator Draskowski. I appreciate the commissioner being here, and I trust Commissioner Marquardt much farther than I trust a lot of commissioners. But the reality of it is that it's also the Department of Revenue that I think is the only agency that can appeal directly to the state Supreme Court. And they, if they disagree with a tax court ruling, I believe that that's what they should do. And I don't think we should allow them, in retrospect here, thinking about this bill, the opportunity to make a decision not to follow a tax court ruling with any other type of notice. And I'm not going to make an amendment to your bill today, Madam Chair, but I'd like you to think about that, that we take away that opportunity for a lack of communication to occur. And if they wish to appeal, then appeal. And make sure that the decision and it is made once and for all, and not run the risk of non-transparency to even a small group of taxpayers. Thank you.
Thank Senator you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Weber. I would hope also that the tax court will be far more specific and communicative in their findings, and really check them over for the ambiguities that may arise, both for the Department of Revenue and the commissioner and the taxpayer, who just may not even understand what part of a ruling may be. And so I think there's there's maybe attention to detail that is should be recommended to both entities that are involved in the cases before the tax court.
Senator Rust, before we go,
Mr. Chairman, I would then ask you to lay the bill over as amended.
Senator Rust, I've just been notified that Chief Justice is here and would like to testify.
Oh. I'm sorry, she was not on the witness list. So I was unaware that she was going to appear. She did not notify the committee. But if she would like to, then we welcome her testimony.
Welcome to the committee, Chief Justice Bowman and Mr. DePasquale.
Thank you, and good morning, committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Jane Bowman. I'm Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court, and I am joined by my colleague, Judge Brad De La Pena, also on the Minnesota Tax Court. I had reached out to Senator Rest earlier, and as judges, we try to stay in the shadows a little bit when it comes to legislation because that's not necessarily our role. So I did state that I would be here if needed, and I appreciate the opportunity to address the tax court's concerns with this pending legislation. So a brief reminder, as many of you recall from our confirmation hearings last year, the Minnesota Tax Court is an executive branch agency, and our decisions are appealed by right to the Minnesota Supreme Court. So those who disagree with our decisions skip the Court of Appeals, and they also skip the writ process, whereby the Supreme Court decides which cases it chooses. The Supreme Court must take appeals from the Minnesota Tax Court, which is different from the judicial branch. And I overemphasize that point for reasons that will become clear. The second point I want to make is that I think we all agree here today that the circumstances that arose from the Nadler decision were unfortunate at best, and that we all agree, as Commissioner Marquardt stated here today, that it is the responsibility of government agencies to be transparent. So with that, we do support binding the Commissioner of Revenue to tax court decisions, which is included in this bill. We have serious concerns about allowing disagreement by revenue notice rather than by Supreme Court appeal or asking the legislature for a revision. The problem is that a revenue notice disagreeing with a tax court decision creates legal uncertainty that may persist for years, rather than appealing and getting an answer from the Minnesota Supreme Court. Importantly, there is no need to create this new mechanism of disagreement because the current means are more than sufficient. And I am going to turn it over to my colleague, Judge De La Pena.
Sir, I don't have you on the list. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Brad De La Pena. I'm a judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill is titled Commissioner Bound, but actually does create an entirely new mechanism for disagreement with a tax court decision. Let's assume for purposes of discussion that the commissioner disagrees with the tax court decision. The commissioner has an appeal as of right to the Minnesota Supreme Court. No other agency head can insist on Supreme Court review, but the Commissioner of Revenue can do so. That appeal will authoritatively settle the disagreement. Once the Supreme Court decides a matter, that is the law and binds all agencies and citizens of the state of Minnesota. Providing that the commissioner is bound by tax court decisions he does not appeal, which is the main thrust of the bill, does likewise settles the law, at least in the interim, because the tax court's ruling becomes the law, and there is no legal uncertainty. Under either scenario, if the commissioner remains dissatisfied, he can come here to seek a law change implementing his position. That is, after a Supreme Court decision that he loses, or to revise a tax court decision with which he disagrees. There's always the possibility of coming to the legislature and obtaining a law change. So, under either situation, there will be no legal uncertainty for taxpayers. If the commissioner appeals, the Supreme Court's decision is the law. If the commissioner decides not to appeal and to be bound by the tax court decision, then the tax court decision becomes law. As this example shows, the commissioner has ample institutional means already available to pursue any disagreement with a tax court decision. In contrast, allowing the commissioner through a revenue notice to disagree with a tax court decision rather than appealing the decision creates legal uncertainty. And you heard these tax representatives talk about that. Taxpayers will be unfairly forced to decide whether to rely on the tax court's decision on the one hand, or instead to rely on the revenue notice disagreeing with the tax court's decision. And that, so there will be no definitive law to follow. Taxpayers are forced to guess. And this uncertainty can potentially exist for years, as it did following Nadler. This is why we are concerned about disagreement via revenue notice as an exception to the commissioner being bound. Don't create an exception to the commissioner being bound. And don't do it because you will create unnecessary uncertainty for taxpayers.
I would close the comments by
Supreme Court
you
Justice.
Need to address the chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. I apologize. I'd close by noting that making the tax courts binding on all litigants, save for Minnesota Supreme Court decisions that obviously bind the tax court, makes our job easier because then we get clear direction from the Minnesota Supreme Court so that we can treat litigants fairly. Thank you.
Thank you, judges, for coming. Member questions or comments for the judges? Senator Rest, any further comments after that testimony?
No, Mr. Chairman. I would hope you would lay the bill over.
As I will. Senate File 4725 as amended is laid over.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the meeting.
Tax Committee is adjourned.